stand by. Good day, everyone, and welcome, and thank you for joining us for today's IBM teleconference, The Dynamics of Monitoring Dynamic SQL with Omegmon XE for DB2, PM, and PE. Today's teleconference will last approximately 60 minutes and will include a live question and answer session. This teleconference will discuss how to measure and understand the impact of dynamic SQL on the DB2 subsystem using Omegmon XE for DB2 PMPE. The speaker for today's teleconference is Ed Woods, Consulting IT Specialist. At this time, I would like to hand it over to our speaker, Ed Woods. Ed, please go ahead.
Hello. Once again, my name is Ed Woods with IBM Corporation. I want to thank everyone for taking the time to be with us today to talk about Omegmon XE for DB2 PMPE and applying this towards monitoring and managing dynamic SQL. I put this presentation together just based on things I've seen in the field working with customers over the years. I think it's an area of interest because more and more I'm seeing this area where dynamic SQL is becoming a much greater relative part of the overall workload on DB2 systems in many shops. In some environments, dynamic SQL might be the lion's share or even as much as 80-90% in a lot of cases of the overall workload, depending upon the nature of the application, the subsystems, etc. Certain applications are built around this whole notion of using dynamic SQL. So my perception is that when using Omegmon in these kind of environments, there is additional considerations over and above what you may want to consider when using Omegmon in the more traditional sense. And so what we're going to talk about today is the information that's in Omegmon that's relevant to dynamic SQL, and maybe some nuances and subtleties and things you can do to use Omegmon more effectively in this kind of an environment. And we'll look at several examples, look at capabilities that's there, things you may or may not be aware of, strategies. We'll talk about the cost of monitoring and gathering data, the relative traces and things like that that are involved, give you information specific to the cost of various trace options and collection options and things that are available with Omegmon. So going to the next slide, which is the agenda slide, we'll talk a little bit about what is dynamic SQL, mention a few of the concepts. We'll talk about some of the numbers and things that you might want to be aware of when we're talking about managing and monitoring dynamic SQL. We'll talk a little bit about the cost of dynamic SQL. When we refer to dynamic SQL, there are some additional potential costs that are involved when doing a heavily dynamic type of a workload, and we'll talk about what those are. We'll look quite a bit at the performance and availability information that's available, the types of information, statistics, accounting, performance type information, the various granularities and strategies in terms of how this data may be gathered. We'll talk about the Omegmon facilities, what's available in Omegmon XE for DB2 PMPE, what capabilities you might want to turn on, what capabilities you might want to use in certain circumstances, what's more efficient than other ways of doing things, etc. And then we'll just look at several examples of using Omegmon to gather and analyze dynamic SQL performance data. So going to the next slide that says, what is dynamic SQL? Well, from one aspect, dynamic SQL is really a function of perspective, and we can look at perspective in a couple different ways. From the perspective of the application, you can either have static or dynamic SQL. Static SQL is what we would traditionally think of as SQL that's more or less hard-coded to some extent into the application code, specific SQL text that's coded in, and it goes through the standard bind process, et cetera, and then off it goes to DB2. Dynamic SQL, on the other hand, is SQL text that might be generated by the user or may, in fact, be generated by the application. We'll talk about why in a slide or two. From a DB2 subsystem perspective, so now it's DB2 that has to take the SQL call and then execute it. Well, static SQL is, of course, SQL that has been precompiled via the bind process, et cetera, and so DB2 already has the necessary access path information in order to go ahead and execute the necessary calls. It knows how to go and get the data. Dynamic SQL, on the other hand, is SQL that has not been bound before execution, so DB2 must be able to then turn, take that SQL text and interpolate it into something that may be executable from a DB2 subsystem perspective. And so, of course, that's work involved to be able to do that. So going to the next slide that says, why dynamic SQL? Well, dynamic SQL is important for many types of application structures and design points. in certain cases, when we're talking about just application design and coding from a flexibility standpoint, dynamic SQL may work better just because of the needs of a given application, the various possible permutations and combinations of SQL that may need to be generated. Sometimes dynamic SQL just works better in that type of a construct. Other types of applications may just favor dynamic SQL just from a pure infrastructure standpoint. The idea is, a good example might be if you're a heavy WebSphere shop and the developers favor JDBC over SQLJ, you'll see then, of course, much more dynamic SQL activity. If you're a shop that runs a lot of ERP-type applications, those ERPs are going to use dynamic SQL quite a bit. So either from a design paradigm standpoint or just from an infrastructure standpoint, dynamic SQL may be heavily favored in your shop. So going to the next slide that says, understanding the costs of DB2 access path selection. The thing to always be aware of is that DB2 is built upon the notion of a cost-based optimizer. What that means then is one of the things that DB2 has to do is take that SQL call and that text, if you will, and then interpret it and turn it into something that is executable by the subsystem. DB2 has to do a lot of analysis in order to know how to go out and get that data. And so that could be authorization checking, validity checking on the front end, and then going out and getting the necessary catalog information, how many rows, how many pages, of calculating filter factors, looking at distribution stats, and then actually go ahead and determining the optimal access path from that point. There's a lot of code and a lot of clever code that goes into the DB2 optimizer. So because of that process, DB2 has to be able to take that SQL text and turn it into something that is executable and usable by the subsystem. The issue that can come up when we're talking dynamic SQL is this whole process of access path selection, or APS, maybe have to be done repetitively, many times over and over and over and over again. And so it may be not so much that APS itself is expensive, but the cost of doing APS redundantly and repetitively many times over is where the cost of this processing may add up. So going to the next slide that says, what are the costs of dynamic SQL? Well, the cost of dynamic SQL can happen in several different aspects. First and foremost, you have the CPU cost of doing this repetitive APS processing that I was just describing on the prior slide. So access path selection has to be done because DB2 has to have some way of turning that SQL text into something that's executable and usable. So there's going to inherently be cycles involved. Maybe just looking into individual prepare, that's not a big deal. But if we do that same prepare many, 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 many times, then that cost adds up. Also, there could be costs involved if, let's say, for example, we turn on some of the caching mechanisms that allow us to cache and keep that APS information around for SQL text. Well, that there's costs involved with maintaining that cache, keeping it around, searching that cache, etc. So there could be cycle costs involved in that aspect. Also, there's subsystem and I/O costs. APS is going to require information from catalog, for example, in order to get information about objects, to calculate filter factors, look at distribution statistics, etc. And so there's overhead that goes into the subsystem in the form of just the I/O necessary to get the required information out of catalog to do APS. There are memory costs that are involved as well. These memory costs could take the form of the various caching mechanisms that you may want to turn on in order to defer some of the cost of redundant APS. So you can avoid the cost of doing a lot of repetitive APS, but that will then in turn drive some additional memory utilization and potentially a lot of memory utilization depending on how you size these particular cache mechanisms. There's also an analysis cost as well. And the analysis cost falls in the realm of you may need to consider doing your performance and tuning from a different perspective than you would with statically bound applications as they may have been done years ago. The idea is dynamic SQL in a way is a bit more of a moving target, just owing to the name itself, the dynamic aspect. It does mean that you may want to consider gathering performance information and analyzing things from a slightly different perspective. It is more of a moving target. Going to the next slide that says dynamic SQL statement caching options. As I implied before, you can use the various caching mechanisms inside the DB2 subsystem to defer or defray the cost of doing this repetitive APS processing. Now, there's various caching options you can take. You can say the no caching option, which is basically then going to say that each time a statement is executed dynamically, it must be prepared, depending upon application logic. Then there's the local dynamic SQL cache. Basically, what that will do then is that will cache the SQL information, keep the APS information around. This is a bind option, the keep dynamic bind option, and will allow that APS information to be kept around across commits of the application. Then there's another level of caching called the global dynamic SQL cache. So I could optionally turn on the global but not have the local on. In this case, then, there would be some additional SQL information that would be kept in the DBM1 address space, and that's activated with the cache dyn ZPARM set to yes. And then there's the full caching option, which basically combines the two, the keep dynamic option with the cache dyn option, and gives you caching in multiple different levels. Now, you can always turn both of these on, but, of course, the more you turn on, the more you enable, potentially the more storage, et cetera, that's required to be able to maintain and manage and use these caches. So there's an inherent trade-off that you have when you're looking at these things. The cost of creating the cache, keeping the cache around, versus the cost of the APS and being able to avoid access path selection on a repetitive basis. That's part of the inherent trade-off of this question. Just like you have various caching options, if you go to the next slide that says types of prepares, there's different types of prepares that you can look at as well. There is the full prepare, which is basically we're starting from ground zero, we're taking some SQL text, taking it through access path selection, and then DB2 goes ahead and executes the call from there. And then, assuming, depending upon the various caching options and where things are cached, how they're cached, if it's a cache hit or not, you can get various types. You can get a short prepare, you could avoid prepare altogether, or depending upon option set and what limits are set, you might actually get scenarios where in DB2 will implicitly do a prepare under the covers on behalf of the application. And so depending upon the type of prepare, the nature of prepare, you'll get a significantly different cost in terms of how much it costs to do this particular dynamic SQL call. Going to the next slide that says dynamic SQL poses performance analysis challenges. And I mentioned this before. It's the dynamic aspect of dynamic SQL that poses the additional performance analysis challenges in a lot of cases. As I said earlier, dynamic SQL is much more of a moving target, just owing to the very dynamic nature, as the name implies. So it may be more of a challenge in certain cases to isolate and tune problem SQL. And ultimately, in many circumstances, when we're talking DB2 performance analysis, we're still talking the whole challenge of identifying problem SQL, tweaking and optimizing that SQL, and then going back, fixing it, and then moving on to the next challenge. So because dynamic SQL may potentially have more permutations and combinations, it may be more of a challenge to get to that problem SQL. So as a result, tracing an analysis strategy for dynamic SQL apps may be different than statically bound applications. Might require more thought and planning to get down to the problem SQL. Might require you do more tracing or different types of tracing than you would with a statically bound application. Ultimately, getting down to that SQL level detail, as I said, is still important. And any time we're talking about using tracing, trace mechanisms, looking at different levels of performance data, there's always an inherent trade-off. What net and trade-off is the cost of gathering the data relative to the value of the data. There's an inherent trade-off that's involved. Anytime you gather trace data, even if it's something as basic as statistics traces versus accounting versus various performance traces, there's going to be an inherent trade-off in terms of the cost involved, the quantity of data gathered, and then ultimately the retention analysis. When we're talking dynamic SQL, all these factors need to be considered. The cost of the traces, the relative value of the data gathered, the quantity of data that's going to be gathered, and then ultimately how that data is going to be retained. And then once it's retained, how do you then in turn go back and parse through the data to find the problem, call, and question. Going to the next slide that says, gather information in multiple levels of detail. In this example, I just kind of go through the main three categories of traces that we'll be talking about in this session today. At the base level, you have your statistics traces. The statistics traces are for the subsystem level. At the subsystem level, relevant information that you'll find will include things like the number of calls by type, get statistics on things like the dynamic SQL cache, hit activity, for example, load activity. And this information is kept for the subsystem level, and it's kept based on a time interval so that you can use a Megamon then to in turn determine that for a given interval in time, how many of these type of events occurred, how many prepare calls, how many accesses to the dynamic SQL cache, etc. The next level down is the accounting traces. Accounting traces take things down to the application level. So statistics traces look at things at the subsystem level. Accounting traces look at things at the application level. So here again, you can get call count activity, cache activity, etc., but now we're looking at things at the level of the individual application. Now, depending upon the application that's involved, this may or may not have quite a bit of value. And so in other words, some applications, if it's doing heavy thread reuse, etc., let's say, for example, everything's going through disk serve and it's going through a generic ID, then the accounting traces might give you some level of information, but it may not be quite as granular as you need in all cases. You may need to do additional analysis from there. Other applications, the accounting traces will give you a good breakout specific to the application, and the accounting traces are ultimately the starting point when you want to do application analysis, which then in turn takes us to the next level of tracing, which is the performance traces. These are the detailed level traces. This is the most granular level of tracing. This is where you then in turn ultimately get down to the individual SQL call level of detail, as opposed to looking at things just from a subsystem or an application perspective. So the performance traces basically give us the most granular level of information, the most detailed, and then of course the thing is that that's where you need to apply the most thought specific to how you use these traces. Going to our next slide that talks about Omegamon performance information collection and retention strategies. This is where the whole notion of collection and retention becomes important, because ultimately that's one of the big values of a real-time monitoring tool such as Omegamon, is it gives you a mechanism to view the data, to view data interactively, real-time, but also to gather data in a variety of ways in a historical construct, and then go back and look through that over a period of time. And that's where the whole notion of collection and retention becomes essential, because especially when we're talking dynamic SQL, I think having a sound strategy of retention and having the ability to go back and pour through that data over time is essential to be able to get down to the level you need to get to for dynamic SQL analysis. So going through the three categories, statistics traces, those are low overhead, low volume. Low volume meaning that there's not going to be a large quantity of records that gets generated. So virtually every shop should be running statistics traces. That's important data, something that should be run on an ongoing basis. And the retention could be either viewable in the real-time monitor. You can send it to the Omegamon near-term history files, which we'll talk about in a bit. You can also run that data to SMF or run it to multiple places, including SMF. And there's also snapshot history mechanisms we'll talk about as well. So statistics traces you typically will need. Accounting traces, those are a much higher volume of data. Depending upon thread reuse options, how your applications are coded, ZPARM options that are specified, things such as ACUMAC, for example, if you're doing thread reuse, there's a whole variety of different things that could come into play. Typically, though, accounting trace data is going to be a high volume of data. So in other words, a lot of records of accounting data are going to get generated, and they're fairly large records as well. Still, overall, relative to the app and the subsystem, the overhead is relatively low. The cost is usually more in the form of the cost of just gathering and retaining and keeping the data around and then pouring back through it later. It's important to be able to view this accounting type data in real time, as well as be able to go back through a near term and pull that data as well. Many places also send the accounting data to SMF, and then the data is extracted from SMF at a later time. So while accounting generates a high volume of data, it's very important data in that it gives you the ability to look at things down to the application level. So that makes the data valuable, even though there is an inherent cost when we're talking about gathering it. And then finally, we have performance tracing. Performance tracing is usually the big wild card. Performance tracing, as I said before, gets us down to the granularity of the individual call. Depending upon the classes of performance traces that are enabled, the types of traces you may gather, what you may be looking for, the cost could be relatively low to fairly high, depending upon what you're trying to do. So this is where data volume, retention, and then strategies in terms of going back and gathering the data may come even more into play. You may run performance traces for a period of time. You may run it for a longer period of time. In terms of general retention, you probably don't want to just send a lot of performance trace data to a place like SMF. This is where you want to consider things such as using the Omegamon application trace facility or turning on certain components of the Omegamon near-term historical or something like that. So now that we've kind of talked about the general introduction, let's discuss some of the facilities of Omegamon. So let's go to the next slide that says Omegamon XD for DB2 PMPE V4.1. So Omegamon XD for DB2 version 4.1, that is the currently generally available release. Many of you customers might still be on 3.1. The V4.1 version has been available since fourth quarter of 06. This slide lists many of the major features and components of Omegamon DB2. So we have real-time thread analysis. We'll look at some examples of looking at threads from a real-time perspective and looking at accounting data and look at the relevant data for dynamic SQL. There's also real-time DB2 subsystem data where we can look at things like virtual pools, EDM pools, look at pool performance and snapshot analysis. We'll look at examples of that as well. There's also storage analysis data, the IFKID 225 type information. I'll show you an example of that. We'll talk quite a bit about the application trace facility, how that can be used to gather and analyze and look at that performance trace data. You have a choice of interfaces. You have your Tivoli Enterprise Portal, the PE GUI, 3270 interfaces. Each of these may be used in specific ways and have specific capabilities, and I'll show you examples of each of these as we go through. Other relevant things, let's see, near-term historical. Near-term history, I think, is a very important feature when we're talking about managing dynamic SQL-based applications, because this is a good way to address the challenge of retention that I implied earlier. Basically, you can gather certain key pieces of dynamic SQL, including dynamic SQL text information, and store that correlated with the relevant accounting data, and then pull that interactively into your Omegamon DB2 views using the classic interface, for example. There's a variety of capabilities specific to historical, batch reporting, the Omegamon XD Tivoli Data Warehouse, snapshot history mechanisms in the PE GUI. There's also Performance Warehouse. Each of these has its own unique and important capabilities. So going to the next slide that says options and interfaces. So there are several interfaces that you can use with Omegamon DB2. We'll look at the top one that shows the XD GUI interface. We'll talk quite a bit about Classic. There's quite a few useful capabilities in the Classic interface. We'll look at the PE GUI. The CUA interface is still there and available for users, although it is largely delivered more or less on an as-is basis at this point. The long-term direction is that CUA interface will ultimately be phased out in lieu of having Classic as the go-forward 3270 interface. And we will continue to maintain, enhance, and support Classic 3270. So some people ask if it's always going to be GUIs and we're not going to have 3270. We will always have a 3270 interface. So going to our next slide that talks about analysis, collection, tracing options, etc. So from a real-time analysis standpoint, you could use any of the Omegamon interfaces, Classic, CUA, the PE GUI, the Tivoli Enterprise Portal. to do a real-time analysis of threads, of subsystem statistics, and get the relevant counters for each of these, specific to dynamic SQL. From a historical standpoint, you have more options and choices, and there's unique facilities for each of these. When we're talking classic 3270 or CUA 3270 interface, you have what we call the near-term history. Near-term history basically will provide you with the last N hours of history. Now, I just say N because the amount of data that's available is a function of how you configure the tool. Basically, how near-term history works is it takes accounting and stats and certain performance data and rolls it into a set of VSAM files. How much data is retained is a function of the amount of data that's being written to the files, the size of the files themselves, and also the number of files. And so you may size these based upon the anticipated amount of data and what your retention requirements are. You have a lot of flexibility in this regard as a result. The fundamental benefit of near-term history is to give you the ability to see what's happened over the last few hours so that you don't have to wait until tomorrow's SMF cutoff or whatever, or use other trace mechanisms to gather the data. It's there, available, readily accessible within the tool. Tivoli Enterprise Portal has its own unique history capabilities as well. The Tivoli Enterprise Portal allows you to snapshot relevant information gathered by the Omegamon XC interface and sends that data to the Tivoli Data Warehouse. The Tivoli Data Warehouse is a warehouse construct that can reside on like a Windows box or something like that so that you can then interactively use the Tivoli Portal to pull back history data for trending and analysis purposes. And then last but not least is the PE GUI interface. It has its history capabilities as well. The PE GUI has a very nice snapshot history capability that I'll show you in a couple minutes. And then there's also what's called the Performance Warehouse. Performance Warehouse basically allows you to build what amounts to a performance analysis database that can be managed by the Omegamon task itself. And you can specify rules whereby you can control how the data is collected, how the data is retained. There's analysis capabilities built into Performance Warehouse. So as I implied earlier, one of the big challenges of dynamic SQL is the challenge of how do you determine what's the optimal collection, what's the optimal retention, and then also once it's retained, how you go back and analyze the data after the fact. And all of these things can be addressed by using a mechanism like Performance Warehouse. So going to our next slide, which says relevant information from the classic interface. So what we're going to do now is we'll step through some examples going from a stats level, then to accounting level, then to a performance trace level. And I'll show you some examples of the data that's relevant. So the primary menu of the classic interface, which is called Panel Z Menu, a lot of the information might be available from option R on the main menu. That takes us to the Resource Manager display. And then from there, you can then get into the EDM pool displays. You can also then in turn go into the option J to see SQL level count information. There's also an option M for storage analysis. So there's several options off of the resource manager selection to get relevant data. Also from a historical standpoint, option H will let you get to the historical data. So at several different points, you may want to look at the relevant DB2 data. So going to the next slide that says DB2 statistics information analyzing from a subsystem perspective. When we're talking statistics level information, there's quite a few counters that are maintained and gathered on an ongoing basis by Omegamon. And if you remember things like the various types of prepares and things like that that we mentioned before, Omegamon will show these counts and will show them on an interval basis, a rate basis, etc. And so we see, like in this example, how many prepares were done, how many prepares were avoided, how many implicit prepares were done. You also see just the overall count of the number of prepares for the interval. And then you also see counts on things like how many dynamic SQL cache requests there were, how many loads there were into the pool, etc. So these types of statistics counters may be shown on an interval basis, and this is something that's interactively available within Omegamon. You just go to the appropriate classic screens, and the data is there for your perusal. The next slide shows comparable data, but now we're looking at it from the perspective of the Tivoli Enterprise Portal. The Tivoli Portal is an interface that runs within typically a browser, and it's just a common conduit whereby all the various Megamon XD capabilities of Megamon XD for DB2, Kix, IMS, ZOS, etc., all use this common paradigm. So we see in the example here, we see counts on dynamic SQL cache requests, loads, etc., very comparable kind of information to what we were looking at on the prior screen. One thing that the Tivoli Enterprise Portal is very good at is providing you with a high-level overview of what's happening across all the DB2s, but then if you look at the next slide that says Tivoli Enterprise Portal situations may alert on key performance metrics, one of the strengths of Tivoli Enterprise Portal is not only from a monitoring standpoint, but also driving alerts and actions off of that. So that's one area where when I typically suggest to customers, what's the optimal way to use the tool? Well, a great way to use the Tivoli Portal is to use it as your high-level analysis mechanism and also your alert component, if you will, your alert manager of managers. And so in this example, we're looking at a situation where we're checking if the percent of SQL cache loads goes above a certain percent, then we're going to generate an alert off of that. And so what would happen is you specify the criteria in the middle, where in this case we're just looking at a single metric, which is if it's above a certain percent. And then you would click on the action tab that I have highlighted over on the upper right side, and that action tab is where you can specify commands. And those could be console commands, those could be commands that turn and then drive other notifications and automated actions, etc. This is a very simple alert we're looking at here, just a single number, but you could add additional Boolean logic, add additional items of information, add additional metrics to this as well. And so the situation paradigm is powerful from the Tivoli Portal standpoint because it then gives you what amounts to an automated engine that's integrated directly within the monitor. Going to our next slide, so where Tivoli Enterprise Portal provides the high-level overview, the Classic 3270 is the deep dive analysis piece. Classic 3270 provides a real-time view, such as what we're seeing here, of our statement cache usage, dynamic SQL cache requests, loads, etc. But you can also issue the option H to see near-term historical data and then do additional cache mapping and analysis from here as well. If you see option A on the third line here, that would be your EDM pool snapshot. That's where you would then in turn go in to see the individual SQL calls within the DSC. We'll look at examples of that in just a bit. The next slide is where we'll talk a little bit about the near-term history. I mentioned this before. I want to talk a little bit about the various history options because I think one area that's important is understanding what the collection and retention options are that you have available in a Megamon. And so we'll look at a couple, three different examples of what we're talking about here. So the near-term history, how that basically operates is for each of the DB2s that you may be monitoring on a given LPAR. So in this example, we have a DB2A and a DB2B. For each one of those, there is a history collection subtask that executes within a Megamon and then in turn stores that data in a set of VSAM files. Once that data is hardened into the VSAM files, that data may be viewable directly by a Megamon. How big you make the files, how many files you have, that basically then in turn controls how much data is available. If you size the files appropriately, then you can have several hours worth of information or even a whole day's worth available. It really is just a function of how much data and how big you make the files. Once the data is there, it's available to the Megamon 3270 interface. Now, what information can be retained in there? You'll have your statistics data. You'll typically have your accounting data. And then depending upon some of the other options you specify, you may have some additional performance trace type data, which would show you dynamic SQL text and other key indicators as well. The information that you gather, this is just part of the configuration options that you specify when you define near-term history collection options. And I'll show you an example of those options in a bit. So the next slide shows just an example of how you can get the last N hours of data. So in this example, We see EDM pool statistics information. These are statistics-type data. So we'll see these things gathered on 15-minute intervals, and we'll see things like, do you see load percent, do you see pages used, and then you would position the cursor on the line in question, and then hit F11 to zoom in and get more detail for that specific time interval. So this is near-term history data that's gathered and maintained on an ongoing basis. The next slide shows another interesting capability that comes with the tool as well, and this is using the PE GUI in this particular example here to gather a snapshot history. The nice thing about the snapshot history collection control that you get with the PE GUI is you could do it on different granularities and go back and forth by controlling the slider bar that we see in the middle of the screen. That's the thing I've circled and highlighted. So with this slider bar, you can use the snapshot history mechanisms to kind of scroll back and forth quickly and easily and see what's happening on the system, get the things like the SQL cache information and things that we're looking at on this particular screen here, and then just kind of follow along as the subsystem goes over a period of time. This is a mechanism that you can specify, and it's a separate history collection snapshotting mechanism from near-term history. So they work more or less independently. They're separate tasks that execute. It runs within the same Omegamon collector address space, but they're separate functions. It's just a question of which pieces you choose to enable. The next slide talks about another history mechanism that you might find useful as well, and that is the performance warehouse. Performance warehouse basically addresses many of the issues I've talked about already in terms of collection, retention, reporting, analysis by providing a mechanism whereby you can define the collection, you can define the retention, and you can define the type of reports and have this set up and in essence managed by Omegamon using the PE GUI to drive the setup, definition, and management of these things. And in a dynamic SQL environment where you have a lot of data that might need to be gathered and maintained and parsed, et cetera, on an ongoing basis, having an Omegamon manage that for you might be an excellent way to go. So if you're not familiar with the capabilities of Performance Warehouse, it is worth taking a look at. So we've talked about statistics. We've talked about the various collection and retention options. We've looked at the various facilities that are available in Omegamon. Let's go to the next step now. So on the next slide, let's take a quick look at the DB2 accounting information that's available. When we're talking about things from an accounting perspective, that means now we're looking at things down to the level of the application. So when we're looking at the level of the application, that's where we're going to see number of calls, types of calls, duration of NDB2 activity, CPU information, IO lock, latch, wait, get page counts, if it's call and store procedures, etc., NDB2 times, NDB2 CPU times, buffer stats, all this stuff is available in the accounting trace. Now, the granularity is, of course, down to the application level. This gives you at least a good indication from the application perspective of how many prepares an application is doing, how many and what types of prepares, if the application is able to take advantage of some of the caching mechanisms we've talked about before, etc. So these counts are a good starting point to determine to what extent dynamic SQL may be having an overall impact on a given app. If we go to the next slide, to look at various threads and applications real-time in Omegamon, then you're looking at the plan major command with various minors off of that. And then from this thread detail view we're seeing here, you would select various letters to look at things like the SQL, option G, SQL counts, option F, the current SQL being executed, etc. And this is where you would get a lot of the relevant information to how this particular application is invoking SQL, to what extent, what the relative counts are, etc. Going to the next slide that shows examples of the relevant DB2 accounting trace data. So here we see on the top part things like our NDB2 CPU time for the application. So this would show us things like how many cycles are being used by the app relevant to DB2 workloads. And then underneath that you see a box that shows the SQLS miner output, and this would show the number of calls, the types of calls, and this is where you would see, you know, in addition, the number of selects and opens and closes of cursors, this is where you'd see the number of prepares, etc. And then the next box down highlights another portion of the accounting data that's available real-time in Omegamon. This would be our preparer statistics. So this is where we would see things like if we've used the cache or not, if the prepare has been avoided, if an implicit prepare has been done, etc. And again, this is at the granularity of the application. Now, the next slide mentions near-term history. This is where near-term history can be quite useful from an application perspective, because near-term history, in addition to retaining the stats and the accounting information, can also optionally specify the collection of the dynamic SQL information. So in this example, we've gone from a drill down on a thread information to get into some of the thread accounting data. And then the second part of the panel actually shows where you can retain and store and then peruse the dynamic SQL text and have that interleaved and kept on an ongoing basis in the near-term history capabilities. As I implied before, usually one of the things people want to get to when we're talking about tuning and managing dynamic SQL applications or DB2 applications in general is the SQL code. Since dynamic is more of a moving target, the ability to maybe have a mechanism like this to gather and retrain dynamic SQL text and allow you to go back and peruse it is an excellent starting point to understanding what's happening from a DB2 call perspective and keep that readily accessible. So it addresses the collection challenge, and then it addresses the retention, and then ultimately the analysis challenge as well. The next slide shows the near-term history collection options. And so in this particular panel, we see the options to get the dynamic SQL text in the near-term history. You need to have the option that I have highlighted here that says dynamic SQL. You need to have that set to yes. If that is set to yes, then what will happen is there will be some additional traces that will be started, and that trace information will give you call-level information and will store that dynamic SQL data into the near-term history files. If you want to understand what the relative cost is to enabling that option, then from this panel you would select option B, and that would give you the record information that would tell you how many records relevant to dynamic SQL have been gathered and stored. And then option C would show you the data set status, which would be how quickly the Omegamon near-term history files will fill. So as I said, in this case, you know, when you turn things on, you're going to be gathering more information. That means the files will be filling more quickly, and you want to take that into account. That's part of the balancing act. But if you need that dynamic SQL text, this is an available option you have at your disposal. So going to the next slide, problem isolation using performance traces. This is the most detailed level of DB2 tracing performance traces are. So you want to use it judiciously. You want to use it where it's appropriate. There's going to be wide variances in the trace overhead. The trace overhead could be relatively low to relatively large, depending on how much tracing data you get, how much you ask for, how long you run it for. And then it's not a question only of just running the trace, but then back to the retention analysis standpoint. Once I run the trace, how do I get the data back out? Once I run the trace, how do I peruse and analyze the data? Having a facility like Omegamon makes that retention and analysis much easier, because you have mechanisms like application trace that are available wherein you can go back and peruse that data quickly and easily. But if you want to get down to call level information and you're not running something like near-term history on an ongoing basis, you may need to look at a mechanism like application trace facility or something like that that uses performance traces to get this level of detail. The next slide shows an example of the application trace, or what we call ATF, collection option panel. You can trace to a file. You can trace to a buffer of memory in Omegamon. If you fill in the DSN field there, that means it's going to trace it to a vSAM file. If a file is not created, you can select an option on the top of the panel to actually create a file to run the trace to. You can filter by plan name, auth ID, etc. Then underneath that, you have several switches you specify. Lock data, yes. Scan data, yes. SQL data, yes, etc. And then the mem size is set at the bottom. So if I do not trace to a file, then implicitly it will trace to a buffer of memory in Omegamon. The default 2, you can take it up to 4 meg. The default 2 meg buffer will hold usually about 12 or 13,000 application trace records. In general, that's about what it'll hold. So it'll run for a few minutes depending upon the options you specify. If all you want is just the SQL level info, but you don't need to see all the granular detail of locks and scans and things like that. You just need to see SQL level information. then my suggestion would be set lock data to no, scan data to no, and leave all the other options set to yes. That will give you the ability to run this trace for a longer period of time and get a much broader view of what's going on across the application and let you see more of the SQL text flow. If you need to get that granular, then by all means, you can turn them on. But it's just a question then of how much, ultimately, you're only going to get so many records of information in a given buffer or file. The next slide shows an example of using the application trace facility. So here we've specified our trace start options, and then you would actually use a Megamon to peruse the trace. And so I just showed a portion of what is called the SQL index overview, where you can see here we see our prepare, our open cursor, we do 250 fetches, we do the close cursor, and then you can then in turn position your cursor and do an F11 zoom to drill in and get more detail on each of these. So this will provide then ultimately the granularity down to the SQL call level, and that's where the performance trace capabilities of application trace facility become quite useful. The next slide shows just an interesting example of something I was using, just tracing the prepare cost itself. We talked before about different types of prepares, full prepares, short prepares, et cetera, being able to avoid a prepare. This just shows an example of where this was done in a very small system. I just wanted to get an idea of the CPU cost of doing a full prepare. So here we're looking at the application trace facility. We see the prepare call. We see the NDB2 time, the NDB2 CPU time. And again, note on the NDB2 and CPU times, your mileage will vary depending on your system. This was done in a very small system here. I also show the scan information, number of pages scanned, data and index for this particular prepare. So here we see a relative cost for a full prepare. If you go to the next slide, we see the relative cost for a short prepare. So in this case, we see no scan on the catalog. We see a much lower CPU and NDB2 times, et cetera. And so comparing the two, the short versus the full prepare is 66 times longer than the short prepare. So having caching mechanisms in place can have a very big impact on the overall cost of doing this prepare processing, especially if you're doing thousands upon thousands upon thousands of these prepares on an ongoing basis. So we've talked about statistics, accounting, and performance. Let's talk about some additional options you have available to you with the Megamon to get SQL level and relevant type information. So the next slide says additional analysis and collection options. There's a dynamic SQL cache analysis option that's available if you go into the EDM pool analysis snapshot displays and then do an F11 zoom on the SQL cache line. You'll get a display that looks like that, that will show how many times this call has been executed, the CPU time, elapsed time, and then again, you can position the cursor and do an F11 zoom again to see individual SQL call detail, to see the SQL text, to see the relevant accounting information, etc. The nice thing about this is that it's available, readily accessible, real-time within the monitor, and it's just basically gathered and kept within a Megamon, so you don't have to worry about the retention, quantity of data issues, and some of the other things I mentioned. It's a facility that's just there for your perusal, in essence. So the next slide, use DSC cache analysis to see text detail. This, again, is just using the classic interface in a Megamon to see this kind of information, to see the call text, times executed, your counting times, etc. Again, readily available. You can also use PE GUI to see information quite comparable to this as well. The next slide shows an example of the storage utilization information that you get with a Megamon. One of the things I hinted at before is you have a cost involved with doing the prepares and the cost involved with doing repetitive repairs. Well, in addition, let's say, for example, you decide to turn on some of the various caching options, either turning on the global cache, turning on just the local cache, or going with a full caching option. Any of these caching mechanisms you enable will then, in turn, drive storage utilization within the DB2 subsystem. So inherently, there's a balancing act that's involved. Storage is ultimately a finite thing. Even with the addressability things we have now, there's still ultimately only so much storage that's available within the DB2 subsystem. So you want to have a good understanding in terms of how much is being used by DB2 relative to these mechanisms. And so Omegamon has the ability to provide this type of information. If you're familiar with the IFKID 225 record, these are some of the relevant counters that you would get from that, and these are displayed real-time within Omegamon. And so you can see things, for example, such as local dynamic statement cache control blocks and megabytes, etc., and thread copies of cache SQL statements. All this stuff is broken out and available within the Omegamon DB2 views. So this is how you can then in turn determine, well, if I go crazy and turn on all these cache options, what's the cost in terms of how it's impacting the DB2 subsystem? Maybe I'm using more resource than I want, and I want to wrench it back just a little bit. So going to the next slide, it says forging an Omegamon DB2 dynamic SQL analysis strategy. Well, the first thing you want to do is gather data, measure, establish a baseline. That's always important. A lot of times folks will ask me, well, what's a good number, what's a bad number? They're looking at all these numbers. One thing you get with Omegamon is you get plenty of numbers. What are good numbers? What are bad numbers? My recommendation is always is to start from an area where you think things are running reasonably well. Use that as a baseline. Look at the workload when it's a good day. And if you know what things look like when things are running well, then when things start to go bad, the bad numbers will become more obvious. Because every workload is unique, every workload and every shop is different. It's the classic it depends type of scenario. So you want to gather your statistics data. You want to gather your accounting data and use these as a baseline to determine what's typical profiles for your system and what's a typical profile for your key applications. You can then in turn use what we call the logical tuning methodology. The premise of the logical tuning methodology is that you can then in turn determine, using things like accounting data, what's the overall timeline of the application. Ultimately, you want to get to the question that's at the bottom there, which is dynamic SQL an issue, and if so, how much? Simply because you do dynamic SQL a lot doesn't necessarily mean that's an issue. Maybe you're making very effective use of the caching mechanisms, you're getting very good cache hit ratios, and so overall to the application, it's not impacting the overall application timeline all that much. While so there's an inherent cost, you always have to determine, is there enough of an issue there that I need to actually devote more resource to it? Because as I implied on the earlier slide, if I enlarge cache mechanisms and make caches bigger and tweak bind options, et cetera, there are certain inherent costs that come with that. None of this stuff is free. So going to the next slide that says forging a dynamic SQL analysis strategy continued, this is where we want to then in turn say, okay, what's our collection retention strategy? We have our statistics traces, as I said. You want those to be ongoing. That could be just ongoing to SMF. You could send it to near-term history, use snapshot history, use performance warehouse. All these are options that are available to you. Statistics traces you inevitably will want. It's low overhead, it's highly useful data. Accounting traces, you typically will want to run these ongoing as well. You can send it to SMF. You can also use near-term history, snapshot, performance warehouse. Where you send it, how much data you gather, how you handle it, that's where different shops will have different approaches. Because accounting data is valuable down to the application level, but accounting data also has certain overheads involved, just from a quantity standpoint. And then where it ultimately gets more interesting is, of course, with the performance traces. You have, there are many more options in terms of how many performance traces, if any, you want to run. Do you want to run performance traces just for a window of time? Do you want to run it for an ongoing basis? Say maybe using some aspects of performance trace into near-term history to gather information. That's where the options become more of a, not, I won't say a challenge, but you have more considerations. Then exploit the facilities provided by Omegamon XE for DB2. With classic interface, you have your thread and subsystem real-time views. You can get your near-term history, your application trace facility. All those are available within classic. The PE GUI gives the ability to see thread detail, subsystem detail, real-time. The PE GUI, as I said, has its own snapshot history, and also the PE GUI is where you can use your performance warehouse. And then Tivoli Enterprise Portal, the TEP, that gives you your high-level analysis, your alerting, your automation, and then also you can use this for your Tivoli data warehouse history capabilities. Some other tooling and mechanism options that you might want to consider when we're talking dynamic SQL is IBM also has a component called Query Monitor. Query Monitor is, in essence, an SQL-level monitoring tool that will let you gather dynamic and static SQL, gather that SQL-level information on an ongoing basis, and then lets you analyze and peruse the data in a very flexible manner. So if your question is, I want to have a database, for example, of all the various SQL calls that the system may run and then data mine through that and find the high elapsed time, high CPU calls, Query Monitor might be a tool that will work well in that kind of a construct for you. Another piece of technology that's available is SQL Performance Analyzer. SQL Performance Analyzer is an explain capability that integrates with a MegaMonDB2. And so you can use SQL Performance Analyzer to explain SQL calls and to look at SQL analysis, but you can also, as I show on the next slide, have that SQL Performance Analyzer be invoked from a Megamon. So on the example on the slide says SQL Performance Analyzer integration with a Megamon, we see from the SQL display, you can do an option V to invoke SQL Performance Analyzer, and then there's another panel you would go to actually peruse the explain, like I show in the bottom portion of the slide. So these tools integrate, and these are additional options over and above just base of Megamon. So in summary, dynamic SQL is being used more and more pervasively in many shops and many applications. Dynamic SQL has its own unique performance challenges and considerations, and as a result, you might want to tweak or optimize your monitoring, collection, retention strategy based upon that reality. And just be aware of the various facilities. You have a lot of capability just in base of Megamon when you consider the classic interface, the PE GUI, the Tivoli portal, and all of its unique capabilities, history, performance warehouse, near-term history, application trace facility, all of these things are available for you to use. And with that, that's all I have for a presentation. I'll be happy to take questions. I thank you again for your time and attention. Hello.
Thank you very much, sir. Now we'd like to ask you to participate in a brief electronic survey. Right after the survey, we will have a live Q&A with the presenter. Your feedback is important to us, and we do appreciate the time you take to answer these questions. To participate, simply press the star key, followed by the number that best corresponds to your choice. Please listen to all options before making your selection, and we'll be with you in our first question in just a moment. For our first question today, please evaluate your level of satisfaction with today's teleconference. If it was high, press star 1. If it was medium, press star 2. If it was low, press star 3. And we'll pause for a few moments, and then we'll come back with your second question. And for our second question, was the level of technical information presented in this teleconference? If it was at the right level, press star 1. If it was not technical enough, press star 2. If it was more technical than I needed to hear, press star 3. And we'll pause for a moment before we go to question number 3. For our third question, have you currently implemented OmegaMon XE for DB2? If yes, press star 1. If no, press star 2. For our fourth and final question, we hope you have enjoyed the teleconference today. Please let us know if you are interested in receiving additional information or follow-up regarding the products discussed today. If yes, press star 1. If no, press star 2. And we'll pause for one final moment. And that concludes our survey. Thank you all for your participation. Now let's move to your questions. To ask your question, simply press the star key followed by the digit 1 on your telephone at any time. And now at this time, I'll turn the call over to Ed while we wait for questions.
Okay, well, great. Thank you very much. Once again, I want to thank everyone for taking the time to be here today. Hope you enjoyed the presentation. I had a good time putting this presentation together. We're also doing this a version of this presentation as something that you can download as an article on the what we call the CCR2, the Megamon performance articles that you get on IBM.com. And that's something you can also read and then download and view as well from there.
And our first question today will come from Nick Nur.
Ed, my question is on page 8, types of prepares. You mentioned full prepare and implicit prepare. I understand full prepare and I understand implicit prepare, but in the final analysis, isn't it implicit prepare is just like a full prepare?
Really, in essence, yeah, because basically what's happening is DBT is doing it under the covers.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of the difference is you're not coding up the necessarily coding up the call per se, but it has to be done on behalf of the application by DB2.
Mm-hmm.
So you still want to count it. It's good to just understand the nature of where it's coming from.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The other simple short question is on page 17. Page 17 is. The dynamic SQL DSC requests,
mm-hmm.
Is this a summation of all the requests like the DBD and the CT and the PT? And when I add those together, it doesn't add up. Or maybe I am missing something.
No, you don't add up the CT and the PT. Those are separate entities. We're only looking at number of DSC requests in this example here, and all we're really doing is comparing DSC loads to overall DSC requests and coming up with a percentage of loads. The PTs and CTs, those are totally separate mechanisms.
So these requests are what? They consist of what?
So this would be the dynamic SQL cache. This is the large, the global cache, if you will. And these are the applications going out and accessing, trying to get the prepare type information from the DSC and then executing the call from there. And so this is basically just showing that portion of the activity and the number of times that the DSC has been referenced, if you will, and the number of times that it was necessary to actually go out and load it from the beginning and calculating a percentage thereof.
So isn't it then that DSC is a superset for the DBD and CT and PT?
Well, they're not supersets. They're DBD is database information. CT is plan information. The DSC is a separate pool, if you will. They're all kind of live in that same general area of the EDM, but technically they're separate pools per se.
Hmm. Well, all right. Okay. Thank you, Ed.
Yeah, so the numbers won't add up. So if they don't, that I wouldn't expect them to.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
Our next question will come from Barbara Smith.
The question that I have for you is if you go to page 27,
mm-hmm.
where you are talking about the specific SQL statement,
mm-hmm.
if I have an SQL statement and it's basically doing a join between about 17 tables,
mm-hmm.
and I've got a performance problem with this SQL statement.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything in this tool that would direct me to the table that's actually causing the poor performance?
What you could do is a couple of things. If you recall, towards the end of the presentation, I mentioned something called SQL Performance Analyzer.
Yes.
If you look closely at the example, and the font might be small, but if you look at the lower box, there's an option that says SQL PA. So basically, what you could do is, if you see the SQL text, you could do the command to invoke SQL Performance Analyzer, and that would do an explain on this particular call. And then you'd be able to peruse that explain from within a Megamon. Now, above and beyond that, the other thing that you could do that might give you an idea of what's going on is, let's say, for example, you have one object that is causing most of the grief, and that's because you're just scanning a lot of information. There's a lot of get page and IO activity there.
Exactly.
And in that case, probably the easiest way to spot that would be to use a facility of Omegamon called Object Analysis. Object Analysis will do get page and IO analysis on an ongoing basis on the subsystem, and then we'll give you information down to the table space and extent level. In addition, this will correlate that IO and get page information back to the threads in question. So if you're seeing this as an ongoing problem, you can get that object analysis data from the thread real-time display and then in turn tunnel it down to the object in question. And so if you're seeing one object that's driving a lot of the scan access and that's where the bottleneck is, that facility working with the thread views and stuff would give you that data.
And from the thread, can I then do get to the select statement?
From a thread view, real time, you can always see the SQL text that's being executed by that thread.
Now, is there any way in your historical database that you can do that same type of analysis, even though it's not real time?
In the near term history, in Omegamon 3270, we'll gather scan information, but we don't keep it down to the level of the individual object.
Okay.
So if you want to get the object level, IO get page counts and correlate it to the threads, you can use object analysis and it will keep it for a window of time. And you can alter the window of time that it retains it, but we don't fold that data into near term history, at least not yet.
Okay. Let me ask you another question. As far as your thread information,
mm-hmm.
Do you capture, for example, if it's dynamic SQL, the actual user as well as the program and terminal information?
Okay. So in other words, this is like something that's coming from outside of ZOS and we're going through web servers and
exactly.
Things we want to get. And what happens is a lot of times these servers use generic IDs and things like that.
Right. In other words, what you normally rely on is like the plan or package, or mm-hmm. either you rely on the auth ID, and in those cases, it's going to be the same.
Right. How that basically will work with most applications is that there's areas in the accounting fields and things like that and accounting records that data can be put into, and how that happens is going to vary depending on whether we're talking like an SAP, a PeopleSoft, or a WebSphere or something like that. For example, there's things you set up in WebSphere that'll put fields of information in. Now, depending on the app, some of that stuff may be available and viewable real-time in Omegamon. If that's not the case, let's say, I don't know, there's so many different permissions.
Well, in our situation, I'm talking about SAP.
Right.
And then in the other situation, I'm talking about ODBC applications, but they still all come through DB2 Connect.
Yeah. In SAP, just right off the top of my head, you should be able to see at least some of that stuff. In other words, I don't recall if we show the original sign-on auth ID or not. I'd have to pull up a sample on that, but we can usually get it back to we can usually trace it back to some level, the point of origin, because there is information that's being passed across the wire that we are able to pick up and view real time in Omegamon. Also, always keep in mind that if these applications are populating the data in the accounting fields, that is stuff that should be getting into the actual accounting SMF records, and you should be able to pull it out via that way as well.
Okay. And now, I think one of my understandings was with DB2 Connect version 8,
mm-hmm.
a lot more of that information is passed through,
mm-hmm.
whereas it wasn't before.
Right. Makes it easier to make that happen, yes.
Okay.
And just as a reminder, if you do have a question or comment at this time, you may signal by pressing *1 on your touchtone telephone. And our next question will come from Bill Gannon. Mr. Gannon, your line is open. We'll go back to Barbara Snap.
Yes, this is Tom Wilson. I work with Barbara, and I'd like to ask a question. Does Omegamon provide any analysis as far as expert tuning of SQL, where you can take a statement and analyze it and come up with some viable options to make it perform better?
that's where you would want to get into the realm of what we call SQL Performance Analyzer. That's one of the things I mentioned towards the end. OmegaMon is going to show you the calls. It's going to show you the elapsed time, CPU times, your typical stats and accounting and trace info. Now, if you want to then in turn take that call that you've isolated and do an explain analysis on it, come back with recommendations and things like that, that's where SQL Performance Analyzer comes into play. So there's, and the two tools do integrate, but there is a division of labor.
Okay, but it's integrated with OmegaMon.
Yes, you can run SQL Performance Analyzer as a standalone tool, or you can have it integrate with OmegaMon so that OmegaMon can invoke it.
Okay.
That's all on that question.
Good. Well, thank you.
And was there anything further from this phone line?
No, I think he said he was good with that question.
Okay. All right, we'll try and go back to Bill Gannon.
I have a question.
No, make him acknowledge you first. Are you there?
Yeah, sorry, we had our phone on mute. Sorry about that. We have a couple questions, myself and a coworker.
Sure.
And I actually have an answer to one of the questions the lady asked earlier, historical, and figuring out what objects were in use.
Right.
If you use a buffer pool analysis and you go back to the objects that were used in the access path selection, isolate down to the object, basically, what's being used.
Right. Right.
Information.
Yeah, buffer pool analyzer is an option as well. I didn't really get into buffer pool analyzer, just so people are aware of what that is. There's technically two offerings of OmegaMon DB2. One is OmegaMon XD for DB2 PM. The other is OmegaMon XD for DB2 PE. If you have the PE version, you also get a buffer analysis tool, and that buffer analysis tool provides a lot of detailed object-level buffer analysis tracing capabilities and things like that, and that is a good way to go. I didn't get into that because I just kind of kept it kind of like the common between the two, but that is a capability as well.
Right. Even if you don't have that product, though, you have the option to look at the buffer usage for a thread in history. And if you go by the object being used in history, buffer pools and table spaces are usually supposed to be separated. You can get a good idea about what object if you have a bad object in one SQL statement.
Yeah, if you're fortunate enough to have the object isolated in a pool, and you might if it's a problem object, then that is a valid way to go.
What my questions were, one of them was accounting information. That was the new registers that are available with version 8.
Yeah.
Where you can store the, help me out here, the Active Directory user account information. That can be available in OmegaMon someplace, or are we going to have to write something against SMF?
I think you're probably going to be looking at SMF at this point. There are some of these, some of this information that does appear real-time in OmegaMon. If you're running a certain application like SAP, things like that, you will see some of that stuff. But, depending on what you want to see and how you want to get it, probably the easiest way to be sure to get what you need is to just take it from the SMF records.
Okay, what we were looking for, this is Roy, we were looking for dynamically figuring out who was running a particular SQL at the time. And through OmegaMon, and what we're looking for specifically would be the Active Directory user ID, not an SAP user ID.
Right.
Do with SAP specifically, but it would be like that lady was saying previously, just the Active Directory going through ODBC. That's going through, but you're telling me you don't capture it right now.
Well, you're saying the Active Directory user ID as opposed to the SAP.
Some applications that I'm not familiar with SAP have their own user IDs independent of LDAP.
Right.
I'm just interested in the LDAP or Active Directory, if you will.
Okay. So in other words, you want to know how that person signed on, not how the server is. SAP is an example. I'd log on to SAP with whatever my own ID is, but then in turn it goes through a set of SAP app servers, and those app servers may use a generic ID. For performance reasons to get in. A lot of people want to be able to, in turn, trace that back to the individual user that was doing what.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, I think that's what the woman was asking before. And with a Megamon, you know, we'll pull some of those kind of fields out. I don't recall if we show the ID or not. I'd have to go back and look. You know, we'll give you at least some information so you can work it back to the point of origin.
Well, if you could look that up, it would be terrific, because that is one of our critical pieces. Not that, you know, everything else is a critical piece too, but this is one as far as security is concerned, since we have a generic mainframe ID for everybody to use, because we're handling our security,
right,
the application layer. So as far as a mainframe ID, everyone pretty much uses the same mainframe ID, and they, of course, they don't know what it is. It's buried. But the mainframe ID doesn't do our DBAs any good at all, because everybody's using it. We'd like to get a picture of the Active Directory. Any piece that you can provide in a Megamon, mm-hmm, in a dynamic fashion would help a lot.
Right. Shoot me an email if you would. My email address is woodse, so that's Woods with an E on it, at us.ibm.com. I've got some screenshots of some thread views and things. I'll dig them out. Shouldn't be too hard to do. I'll pull them up, and I can show you examples of how we show these types of threads and the information that's there.
Thank you.
Sure. Be happy to help you.
One last question, if you don't mind.
Sure. Go ahead.
The performance warehouse.
Yes.
The data that's being collected, is it stored in DB2 on the mainframe?
Yes.
Which address space? Do you set up for an individual one, or is it the one that's being monitored?
It actually runs within the Omegamon Classic Collector address space. It's a subtask that runs within there. And so what happens then is when a Megamon comes up, if you've enabled Performance Warehouse, it goes out and it checks to see if there's like a DB2PM database, if the necessary tables and indexes and plans are out there. And then once that infrastructure is created, you have the ability to then go out and specify collection and retention and reporting options and things like that. And then it'll actually go out and start gathering trace data and whatever, and building for you a database of performance information based on whatever criteria you specify. But it runs within a Megamon, in essence.
But now, I have a Megamon, and I'm monitoring 8 subsystems. Which subsystem is that collection going to go to? Is the collection for each subsystem going to go into its own PM database on its own each subsystem?
Well, you could set it up that way.
It's totally modifiable by the user?
Yeah, I mean, you can, you know, however you want to define it.
Okay. Did I actually hear you guys say you're getting rid of CUA?
CUA is going to go away, yes. Now, that doesn't mean it's going to go away next week, but it is at some point going to go away. It is essentially functionally frozen, and it's being frozen in lieu of, on the 3270 layer, the classic interface, and then also the strategic direction is the Civil Enterprise portal for the GUI. But, you know, meanwhile, back at the ranch, we have a lot of users that are still using CUA, so it's going to be around for a while. But you're probably not going to see any major enhancements in it. So, you know, in terms of where you want to go with the tool, you probably, if you're not familiar with Classic, you might want to start learning it, or same thing with the Tivoli portal, at least get familiar with it.
Okay. Classic is in Pinto, right?
I'm sorry, what'd you say?
Never mind. Thank you.
Pretty much. That's it. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
Our next question will come from Lee Wang.
Hi, Ed. Hi.
Hello, Lee.
This is Lee. Just to echo on the question, on the number two question about original DB2 client. Actually, I think a customer will send you an email for you to follow up. But
yes.
Meanwhile, if they use DB2 Connect, we will show the original IP address and the original ID from the client side, from the DB2 Connect monitoring feature.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, if we have the DB2 Connect agent, yeah, okay.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Right, that assumes we have DB2 Connect agent.
Yeah, if that, the client they are monitoring coming from the DB2 Connect gateway,
right,
the Megamon real-time will show the original IP and the IDs.
Correct.
Thank you.
And our final question in the question queue will come from Dale Burleson.
Ed, thank you for the presentation today.
Mm-hmm.
Wanted to ask a question. We don't have a Megamon. I'm not a current user, but on screens 34 and 35, you show how you can take the dynamic sequence and quantify how many executions of each statement you have.
Right.
And I was wondering if you would know if on like 39, screen 39 on the query monitor, does it have similar features in that as well? Because, I mean, yeah, we kind of know where our subsystems, where our problems are, but we have no way to quantify that actual SQL statement.
No, I'm not familiar enough with Query Monitor to know the answer to that. I apologize.
Okay. I know you're the Megamon guy. Thank you, man.
Right.
Okay,
yeah,
bye.
Sorry.
And, Mr. Woods, there are no further questions at this time. I'll turn the conference back over to you for any additional or closing remarks.
Okay. Well, thank you. Well, I really just want to thank everyone for the time, the attention, and the questions. It's always good to talk to everyone, and I look forward to doing this again in the future. Thank you. Have a good day.
And that does conclude today's teleconference. We'd like to thank everyone for their participation and wish everyone a great day.